This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. My name is Alan Scott. This is the place where government actions come face to face with business decisions online at www.bgov.com and of course on the air right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Depot maintenance. Yes, depot maintenance is what I said, and it's a necessary evil, something the Department of Defense budgets for, and by law, no more than 50% of those funds can be spent on contractors, of course, with some exceptions, as there always are. Now, with the war winding down, we'll experience that boost in spending. However, sequestration and budget constraints will make the euphoria short-lived. Bloomberg Government's Cameron Luthy and Robert Levinson analyzed the spending this time around in their latest piece, Defense Depot Spending, War Wind Down Will Give Contractors a Temporary Boost, but Opportunities Will Decline Over Time. Rob Levinson is here with more. Hey, Rob.
Great to be here, Alan. Thanks.
You described the boost in depot maintenance spending as kind of a temporary sugar high. I absolutely love that. Why is it temporary now as opposed to years past?
Well, I mean, temporary in the sense of in recent years because of the war, basically.
Okay.
The wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, they're having to spend extra money. And, you know, Congress has been giving them the money because they needed this equipment. And there's heavy wear and tear on the equipment in combat operations. And so there's some, you know, extra money that's basically going to be there. But as these wars wind down, we're already out of Iraq. We're winding our way out of Afghanistan. And as those wind down, you know, some of that money is going to go away.
Are we handling this similar to the way we did the Persian Gulf War?
Well, in some sense, there is a little bit of a similarity. You know, there's sort of a temporary boost right after the war to say, well, we got to fix all this stuff up in the wear and tear. But at the same time, just as after the Persian Gulf War is now, there's a downsizing in the force structure. And as you basically say, well, we're going to actually get rid of this equipment, then you're really not going to spend the money to, you know, do the depot maintenance, which is the heavy maintenance that's done on this equipment. And so in some ways, it is similar to that post-conflict period after the Persian Gulf War.
We've got multiple branches of service, Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and such. Who is taking the lion's share of this money? I know that it's probably allocated to various branches, or is it just one big pot? As the Defense Department said, Navy gets X, Air Force gets it. How does it break down?
Well, the Air Force gets the lion's share of it. And, you know, that probably has to do with, you know, aircraft sort of need more maintenance. You mm-hmm. know, the temperatures and the speeds and things, they just create more wear and tear. And the Air Force equipment, a lot of their fighter aircraft are getting fairly old now. You know, the Air Force is in the process of upgrading. They've got the F-22 and they're bringing on the F-35, but those aircraft did not really experience combat operations and are not really going in for depot maintenance. So the older F-15s and F-16s are requiring a lot of work to you know, keep them flying.
Do the contractors that work on these prior to depot maintenance have a sense of what the environment is going to do to the aircraft? You're talking about the F-35. It's not really been combat tested at all. When that does roll out, is there a sense of, wow, how much money it's going to require to refurbish this thing?
Well, you know, we always learn things when we roll out a new system. I recall with the F-22, which is the Air Force's newer fighter, when the Raptor, yeah. when they got those out and they first started to deploy those, they found an issue with the canopies of the aircraft that did the wear and tear on the canopies was much faster and they wore out much quicker. They actually had to go back and I think even redesign some of the canopies because they didn't anticipate some of the impact on the environment, and particularly on stealth aircraft like the F-22 or the F-35 that have these stealth coatings. We know this with the B-2 bomber. Those are very sensitive to the environment, and right. So there are issues with those, and we always learn things as you get the aircraft out operationally and actually start flying it in either combat or training environments. You learn things that you didn't expect, and oftentimes the wear and tear or some part wears out faster than you would have thought, but you don't know that until you really get it out and start operating it on the pace of either training or combat operations.
Are the people that are the manufacturers typically the ones that come in to do the refurbishing?
Yeah, a lot of the times it is. A lot of the times it is, you know, it's the Lockheed Martins that make the aircraft or General Dynamics that makes the tank that will do a lot of that work. There are some, obviously, as you can imagine, there's subcontracts, and there are other companies that can compete for some of that work. But by and large, yeah, it's those big, you know, the guys who actually made the thing in the first place. Because when they say depot maintenance, you know, this isn't the routine field maintenance, you know, the changing of the oil and checking the seals and things like this. This is stripping this thing down to the nuts and bolts and starting from scratch. And oftentimes they're also adding at the same time modifications. They're upgrading the equipment. They're not just maintaining it, but they're adding a new piece of hardware, a new system onto it that isn't paid for out of maintenance dollars. It's paid for out of procurement dollars. But, you know, when you've got the thing stripped down, that's the ideal time to add on these new modifications.
You mentioned something in the study, in the analysis, excuse me. By the way, it's called Defense Depot Spending War Wind Down. Will give contractors a temporary boost, but opportunities will decline over time. The Department of Defense requests $24.1 billion for depot maintenance, which is a 10% bump in 2013 funds. And it's an increase over time, from 2012. You continually see that approximate 10% bump. In the eye of sequestration, how is that money going to be protected?
Well, there's an interesting thing, you know, with there's been the special account for a while since we've been fighting the wars. It's called the OCO account, the Overseas Contingency Operations account. In the early years, the Bush administration, in the early years of the wars, they had supplementals. And then the Congress said, no, we don't want supplementals, but we want it part of the budget, but we want you to segregate it out. And the thing with the OCO funds is that they are not part of the caps. They're not regulated under the caps of sequestration. In other words, they're basically saying to DOD, whatever you need for the war, that doesn't count against sequestration. It still gets sequestered if there is a sequester, but it doesn't count against that number. So DOD has played this game, sort of, it's sort of a budgetary game where they shift some of the depot maintenance into the OCO account, and that means they can add other things into the base budget and not hit those caps and protect some of that OCO money. But Congress is, again, as the wars wind down, this is going to be harder and harder to do because that OCO account is shrinking. You know, it peaked at like 150 or 160 billion. It's down to about 80 billion now, and it's going to continue to go down as we get out of Afghanistan.
With that being said, is there ever a chance that depot maintenance goes on, and with this shrinking pool of money, is there ever an opportunity for us to go, okay, we're done, can't do anymore, contractors, pack it up, go home, whatever's left is for us to fix, like the U.S. military to fix, or do we scrap them at that point?
No, well, in some cases, as we're probably going to do now, particularly in the Army and the Marine Corps, they're just going to scrap equipment. I mean, those forces are going to shrink under every foreseeable scenario. They're going to shrink. So some of the equipment's going to get scrapped. And the others is you don't really not do it. You simply delay it. Right. You know, maintenance is, it's like anything, like changing the oil on your car. You know, you can delay that if you don't want to spend the money today to change the oil. Now, over time, this can be a problem, just as if you don't change oil on your car, eventually your engine will break. They can delay some of this maintenance, particularly on ships. They can push things back and they can slow things down. So if the money gets tighter, that's what they do. They don't just say, we're just not going to do it, unless they're actually scrapping the equipment as part of a, you know, downsizing of the force. So, but they can delay it. There's a lot of flexibility in how fast they do this maintenance.
Gotcha. So as time goes on, obviously the pool of money is going to shrink, but in all likelihood, there's never going to be an opportunity for us to say, let's not fix this. In my opinion, anyway, looking at the pool of money, you just said there's an astronomical amount of money. Granted, it has gone down, but given that we have a finite amount of equipment, and we still have an awful lot of money, and we've gone up 10%, the Defense Department looks like we'll be able to fix everything.
Right. I mean, again, you may slow down the schedules somewhat. But you've got to fix the equipment. And also they can find innovative ways to make things last a little bit longer. Maybe they come up with new materials or things, or innovative ways of doing things, innovative ways of operating. And again, the training schedules, they're doing more and more, for instance, in simulation with training, where guys don't actually drive the tanks, they get in a simulator. Well, if you're not actually driving the tank, you're not doing the wear and tear in the training, but you're still getting the troops trained to the level they need to be. So there's some offset there, and you save some wear and tear on the system that way, and therefore you can stretch out those maintenance requirements.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio 1500 AM, where my guest is Senior Defense Analyst Robert Levinson, who has half of the writing team that has put together Defense Depot Spending War Wind Down will give contractors a temporary boost, but opportunities will decline over time. Cameron Luthy, who is the co-author of this, unfortunately couldn't be here today. Do you mind if we shift gears just a little bit? I want to talk about the sequester itself under the Budget Control Act. There was an awful lot of talk earlier in the year about the sequester's coming. It's almost like the sky's falling. The sequester's coming. The sequester's coming. And for months, it was the lead story on every network. Didn't matter what you were watching, everything related to the sequester, even three, four stories deep. That seems to have changed. And I can't tell you exactly when that switch flipped, but we're not talking about it as much anymore. You might not even see it mentioned in the news. Is this the new normal?
Well, I think what happened, Alan, is, of course, there was a lot of really hyperbolic rhetoric about what was going to happen when the sequester hit. You know, it was sort of, oh my God, all these horrible things are going to happen. And then the sequester hit, and a lot of those things didn't really materialize. They didn't live up to the rhetoric. You know, there were some individual cases you saw with the air traffic controllers.
Sure.
That happened, and Congress reacted very quickly and said, oh my God, this is bad, and they allowed the FAA to move some money around to fix that problem. But by and large, you know, you didn't see that radical impact, that drastic impact that some people predicted. On top of that, you know, you've seen the big defense companies, their profits, they all beat estimates. So far, their profits really haven't seen a major hit. Now, part of that is they've done a whole lot of cost cutting in anticipation of this. So they kept their margins fairly high, their profit margin, things like that. They've also got a huge backlog, and a lot of what the big defense companies are operating on is procurement money from prior years. And so that money's still there, and so it's still coming. Now, I think we are going to see, you know, the story come to the fore again come September as part of the overall budget fights. You know, Secretary Hagel just this week released the results of what he was calling the Strategic Choices and Management Review, the skimmer or the scammer, saying, you know, how would DOD, basically a big study within DOD to figure out how, if we have to live with these sequester level budgets, you know, this $500 billion cut over 10 years, if we have to live with that, what does it mean? And he laid out some pretty stark scenarios for Congress to think about, you know, about what it does to U.S. military capability, making some really hard choices between either stopping or slowing down the modernization of our force and, you know, having people work with older and older equipment, mm-hmm. or conversely, shrinking the size of the force but keeping the technological edge, which has historically been sort of the pattern that the U.S. engages in. We like to keep that technological edge, and we'll probably shrink the force some. But, you know, I think as the budget battles heat up again, and then in terms of the impact, you know, a lot of people don't realize in defense procurement, for example, a lot of that money doesn't get spent in the first year. You know, the outlay cut, in other words, dollars going out the door from DOD in 2013 because of sequester saw about a $20 billion hit. If we assume that in 14 it's a similar size sequester, so you get a $20 billion hit in outlays, but there's also $10 billion from 13 that would have been spent in 14 that isn't spent. So now it's a $30 billion hit, mm-hmm. as opposed to a $20 billion hit. So the 14 is really a big jump, and you'll probably see that reflected even in those big procurement programs, much more so in 2014 than you saw in 2013.
How much of this is the president going to sit back and go, you know what, you said this last year, as this battle wages on, none of it really happened. Huh, I told you. Is there going to be any of that? More of this, as this battle wages on between Republicans and Democrats, what to cut, what not to cut, where can we make agreements? Is there going to be more posturing?
Well, there's probably going to be a lot of posturing. You know, you have a few of these sort of, again, deadlines that create a sort of crisis environment. You know, September is the end of the fiscal year again, so we have to have a continuing resolution. So at what level? The continuing resolution normally reflects last year's budget.
Right.
So do we go with a post-sequester level continuing resolution, which effectively would cut the DOD? Do we go with a pre-sequester level, but then does DOD continue to spend at a higher level until the sequester actually kicks in? Because the sequester doesn't kick in until 15 days after the end of the congressional session, so sometime in January. On top of that, we've got a debt ceiling, which we're going to hit again. And that was the impetus for the whole Budget Control
sure.
Act in the first place.
Sure.
We're going to hit that again in November. So there's all these crises. There's a lot of posturing going on. The Republicans are talking about holding, you know, saying that they're not going to pass a continuing resolution if it doesn't defund Obamacare, which, of course, the president is not going to agree to. So there's real potential for some impact and for some impasses and a real crisis again. So I think we're going to see plenty of that. The fall is going to be very exciting.
Had this happened in the president's first term, do you think if this perfect storm happened now towards the end of his first term, what we're looking at coming up in 2014, do you think he would have buckled? I realize I'm asking you to speculate now, but now looking at his second term, he's comfortable. It's not like he's going anywhere.
Well, right. I mean, the second term in some ways frees the president up a
sure.
bit because he doesn't have to get reelected. So he can take some more risks here. You know, he doesn't have to worry about Jeff. Also, the economy is on a bit of a firmer footing. You know, in the beginning of his first term, of course, the economy was sort of in a tailspin.
Sure.
And he had to do sort of triage to get that. So the economy is on a bit of a firmer footing now, and that gives him some wiggle room. Yeah, I think his willingness to perhaps compromise on some of these things may be less so because he says, look, I don't have to get reelected, and a lot of you guys do in 2014 or something. But it remains to be seen how hard the president wants to push in. And again, the Republicans still haven't figured out what their strategy is, if they really want to do this, like I say, the bit about holding Obamacare sort of hostage or something like that. There's a significant debate within the Republican Party of whether or not that's a good idea or not, really, to push things to the brink like that with the president, knowing that it's very unlikely that the president would, you know, defund what he considers his signature achievement.
Sure. And the doors open up in October. I think it's October 1st when the people begin to start registering with those healthcare organizations during open season, open enrollment and such.
So. Right, right. And there's a big push on by the White House to, you know, get people to enroll, and there's pushes on the other side to keep people from enrolling and things like this. So it's you know, all of that is going to come to the fore. Like I say, so we have a lot going on in the fall that is going to create some real critical moments for, you know, budgetary concerns.
I'm looking forward to seeing what happens. It's interesting to be on the outside looking in and being able to Monday morning quarterback everything.
Well, yeah, and luckily you and I, we don't work for the federal government.
Exactly.
You know, for those folks, there's a lot of turmoil. I mean, they've got furloughs, you know, and lost days of work and lost vacation, and then and now they're talking, well, they may not have to furlough as much, but it's very difficult for those people who've had pay freezes and hiring freezes and furloughs. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty for those folks, and it must be very difficult for them, you know, having to live through this period. It you know, it has a real impact on their livelihood and the bottom line of their households.
Exactly. So to say that sequestration didn't really land with a thud, I realize there are a lot of people who have been impacted by this. I know several. I'm sure you do as well. And our hearts go out to them. And hopefully you too will be able to weather this storm. And only time will tell. Hopefully the Republicans and Democrats can get together and come up with something that'll make everyone happy. But that's probably not likely.
Unfortunately not.
Yeah, that's probably not likely. So his name is Robert Levinson. He's a senior defense analyst with Bloomberg Government. The piece is called Defense Depot Spending War Wind Down Will Give Contractors a Temporary Boost, But Opportunities Will Decline Over Time. Take a look for it. Cameron Luthy was your co-author on this. Sorry he couldn't be there. Hi, Cameron. Say hi. You didn't
hi,
say
Cameron.
Hi. Thank you. Thanks for being here, Rob.
Thanks, Alan.
You're listening to Bloomberg Government's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. As we turn our discussion now to the economy, and to do that, we would be remiss if we didn't bring in our resident big-brained woman. Her name, Dr. Neela Richardson, Senior Economic Analyst at Bloomberg Government. How are you?
I'm great. How are you, Alan?
I'm doing well. I was talking to our friends upstairs in Master Control, and they said, well, who's coming in? And I said, well, Neela Richardson. And they said, oh, she's so good and so sweet. And I went, you obviously don't know this woman.
Well, I do bring them donuts every morning, Alan, so I expect nothing less.
Fine. So, as you are well aware, President Obama has been out on the talking circuit lately, hitting the Tonight Show for the sixth time during his reign as president. Is it considered a reign as president?
Generally not in this country, but...
I'm just throwing it out there. Well, he's bringing up a lot of different talking points while Congress is on recess. Broken healthcare system, changing the tax code, jobs, exports, renewable energy. But one thing that has really gotten me curious is the fact that he says that there is a bipartisan senatorial push to do away with Freddie and Fannie.
Yes, there is, Alan. The plan would be to wind down Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, these two big mortgage giants that we often talk about, over a series of years, and then replace them with some other type of system, one of those options being a government guarantor. So what would happen is that there would be private insurers who would take the first loss if there was something catastrophic that happened in the mortgage market like we saw in 2008. And then after private capital was completely wiped out, that's then and only then would this government agency step in and take the rest of that risk and that loss.
Right now, it's mere speculation that this would work. I know that the bipartisan push is to make this happen. Is the president confident that they are going to come through with a deal to actually say, let's move forward with this?
You know, I listened to the president's speech in Phoenix yesterday, and what I got from that is just because he mentioned this GSE reform plan doesn't mean that it's his priority. He spent much more time talking about how to extend credit to the middle class, how to extend refinance options to struggling homeowners than he did GSE reform. I do believe that the president's priority is in making economic viable options for the middle class, whether it's minimum wage or using a tax overhaul to invest in infrastructure and jobs, and giving some kind of credit extension to struggling homeowners and to first-time homebuyers. That being said, there are two bills in Congress that are vastly different, and that's where the rubber meets the road in terms of the controversy and whether these bills could actually pass both houses, both chambers.
The budget battle plays a big part in this. He mentioned multiple times during the speech in Phoenix that he wanted to ensure that this bubble will not blow up anymore and burst by pushing all of these things into place to ensure that home ownership is a reality. Is that another reality? Could we see another bubble burst should these pieces fall into place the way he hopes?
You know, it's hard to predict the future, but what we do know is that ending Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae would raise mortgage interest rates. And the question I have is, is the American public prepared for higher interest rates on their 30-year fixed loan? Or even more so, is the American public prepared to do away with the 30-year fixed altogether? That's the question I have into it. It's all well and good to intellectually say, okay, the government involvement in housing is too great. Let's dismantle these two big agencies and start anew. But in that transition process, the American consumer will pay the cost of that, and even as banks benefit from it. So, you know, when the rubber meets the road, it'll be interesting to see if the constituents back this congressional proposal.
I like the way he said, heads I win, tails you lose, which is basically what you just said.
Well, for what the president was referring to is this idea that Freddie and Fannie operated with a government subsidy. Mm-hmm. And so they were charged. Their harshest critics said they took all the gain and subsidized all the risk. But though that is a valid criticism, when Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac got too big and too profitable, their essential role in the mortgage market is to provide low-cost funding for mortgages and to make sure that there is plenty of liquidity in the market. So, Alan, when you want a mortgage or when I want a mortgage, it's never a question if we pass the underwriting standards that we can get a mortgage. Now, let's imagine a new system where credit is not as available and it's more costly. That's the new system that may occur in the transition between Freddie and Fannie and this new proposed Senate rule.
I was upstairs talking to some people a moment ago, explaining what we were going to be discussing here on the program, and the gentleman turned to me and said, "So glad I got a VA."
If Freddie and Fannie were to disappear, then you might see that FHA and VA, which are firmly government-backed programs, there's no implicit role there, would take a greater role in helping homeowners. And so, you know, we can expect on that side the government role would increase. You know, during the housing boom, the private markets were about 60% of housing. And so we have in our history a period of time where private market and Freddie and Fannie coexisted. So there is a room for the government and private capital in the market. But the question is how to keep this and sustain this role without creating the bubbles that you mentioned.
Yeah. Should be an interesting remainder of the president's term. I know that he doesn't want to go out on a sour note. Right now, as the budget battle wages on and we're in the eyes of yet another sequester. Should be interesting as time progresses. And I know you'll be back to keep us abreast of the situation.
Absolutely. The president has a lot of economic priorities and he has a polarized Congress. These speeches and these sound bites are meant to cut through all that and get an economic agenda that'll work for the next 3 years.
Sounds great. Her name is Dr. Neela Richardson. She's a senior economic analyst with Bloomberg Government. As always, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
For BGov's Capital Impact on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM, I'm Alan Scott.